how does the organization deal with failure? You know, does it spend most of its time trying to figure out what didn't work and why it didn't work and how we can learn from it so that we improve in the future? Or does it spend most of its energy organizationally trying to figure out whose fault was it and who screwed up and how can we punish, torture, or get rid of that person who made the mistake?
This is the ERP Organizational Change Journal podcast, brought to you by Nessel & Associates, a Newport Beach, California-based ERP organizational change management firm serving the private equity industry. The ERP OCJ seeks to share expertise, insight, experience, and research, and to create effective conversation to help guide ERP organizational change to real, measurable, and verified success. And now, here's your ERP expert and host, the founder of Nessel & Associates, Dr. Jack Nessel.
Hey, Jack here. Today we're going to dive into one of my favorite topics and what I absolutely think, based on anecdotal evidence and formal research, is a fundamental key to ERP organizational change success: transformational leadership. In this episode, our guests will share some ideas behind the art and science of leading transformational change. All of us here at the ERP OCJ hope that you find this podcast useful as we share lessons learned, discover best practices, and explore the human element components of ERP organizational change. In this episode, we will discuss the secret sauce for leading transformational change with Mr. Ian Ziskin. The topic of our conversation today will be based on the book, The Secret Sauce for Leading Transformational Change, in which our guest Ian and the Consortium for Change, or C4C, are the authors. Ian is the president of Exec Excel Group, LLC, has 40 years of experience as a business leader, board advisor, and member, coach, consultant, entrepreneur, teacher, speaker, and author. He's the co-founder and partner of Business Insight Group, co-founder of the Consortium for Change, and co-founder of the Create Project. His global leadership experience includes chief human resource officer and other senior leadership roles with three Fortune 100 companies. He has served on numerous boards of directors and advisory boards, including USC Center for Effective Organizations, USC Marshall School of Business, and Center for Advanced Human Research Studies at Cornell University. Ian has also written or co-edited four books: The Secret Sauce for Leading Transformational Change, Black Holes and White Spaces, Reimagining the Future of Work and HR with the Create Project. His third book is Three, The Human Resources Emerging Executives, and Willby, 13 Reasons Willbys Are Luckier Than Wannabes. And all of the links to these books will be in our show notes. Joining us from Sag Harbor, New York, Ian, welcome to the show.
Great to be with you, Jack. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you today and really looking forward to sharing some of your work and your experience with our listeners. So thank you so much for that. Ian, before we get started here, can you tell our listeners more about yourself? Introduce yourself further, if you would, please.
Sure. Yeah, happy to do it. You know, as you mentioned, I've been in the human resources and leadership game now for a little over 40 years. I'm quite fortunate to be somebody who's somehow stumbled into a career that I love and focus area that I'm very passionate about. Basically, my career, you'd say, divided into two separate but very related chunks. I spent the first 28 years of my career working in large companies in the human resources arena, primarily. Toward the latter part of my corporate life, I was the chief HR officer for two companies, most recently a company called Northrop Grumman in the aerospace and defense industry. And then about 12 years ago, the entrepreneurial side of me started popping out, and I launched my own coaching and consulting firm at that time, Exec Excel Group, as you mentioned, which is essentially a portfolio of a variety of things that cut across senior level coaching, a lot of leadership development work, and advisory work with boards of directors, and smaller, more entrepreneurial kinds of companies, which has been a great experience for somebody like me who spent so much time growing up in larger companies. I've learned a ton from hanging around entrepreneurs, and that's been great. And as you mentioned, Jack, when you're introducing me, sprinkled in between all of those things has been some writing and a lot of speaking. So I'm really happy to be here today to share some of the things that we've learned in putting together this most recent book, the secret sauce for leading transformational change. The only other thing I'll mention is I'm now based in a place called Sag Harbor, New York, which is on the east end of Long Island. And originally from the New York area, spent about 30 years almost living everywhere but New York, traveling around the United States and the world, and now back here in a part of the country I have a lot of familiarity with. And probably the most exciting thing that's happened in my life recently, other than this book that we wrote, is two granddaughters over the course of the last 18 or 19 months. And so that's been a life-changing personal experience.
Congratulations. Thank you. That's awesome. Well, great. Well, thank you, Ian. We're so happy to have you today and looking forward to sharing some of your insights for sure. Before we get started, I do want our listeners to know that one of my last questions to Ian will be, is there really a secret sauce for leading transformational change? After all, Ian does state in the intro to his book that, quote, there really is a secret sauce for leading transformational change, end quote. But as we progress through the questioning for Ian, maybe think about this. There are often many diverse views on leading transformational change. Some views may be founded in anecdotal evidence, shared experiences, and/or research. What we do know is that organizational leaders and their leadership styles can vary greatly, and organizational contexts can vary greatly. And as a result, you often hear conflicting perspectives, insights, experiences, ideas, and views of what leading successful organizational change looks like. But is there really a common denominator or secret sauce to be learned from CEOs, senior business leaders, HR leaders, organizational culture and transformational change experts? Well, I think today we're going to find out, at least get part of the answer, if not the full answer to that question. And it's a question I'm just fascinated by. So, Ian, thanks again. I'm looking forward to diving in here and picking your brain.
Sure. Excited to be here.
So, Ian, the first question is, and again, without giving away the secret sauce, what inspired you to write your book and compile a book just talking about such a topic, leading transformational change?
Yeah, actually, Jack, it was a couple of things combined. Maybe first, sitting here at home, like so many of us were during the peak of the COVID-19 pandemic, you know, I was observing what was happening in the world around us, not only in terms of the significant health impacts, which obviously were enormous and in some cases, you know, very devastating for people, but also economic uncertainty and some of the political division, certainly in the United States, that was starting to emerge around that issue as well, and began thinking, what does it really take for people to survive and perhaps even thrive in periods of large-scale transformational change? This then led me to think about the topic of leading transformational change. I pretty quickly figured out I wasn't really smart enough to write about it on my own. Now, I'm fortunate, as you mentioned, to lead this really fascinating community network of independent coaches and consultants that we call the Consortium for Change, or C4C for short. And it's about 75 or so independent, very successful and experienced coaches and consultants, many of whom are also quite expert in and very interested in the topic of leading transformational change. So part of what inspired me to write the book was the opportunity to collaborate and bring many disparate, diverse perspectives to this book. I've more recently become rather fond of calling it 200 voices in under 200 pages, because between the essays that people contributed and the interviews with senior level leaders that they conducted and the survey input that we received, we literally do have about 200 voices that have contributed to the book. And as it turns out, and I'm sure you and many of your listeners know, you talk to publishers and a lot of other people in the world, what they'll tell you is people don't really read books anymore. And so the 350 or 400 page book, while there's many great ones out there, it's become more and more difficult for people to get through. So part of our objective was bring to bear these collective perspectives on transformational change, some of which mutually reinforce one another and some of which may actually conflict. But do it in a brief enough and pragmatic enough way that people can get through it, and literally doing it in our case in 199 pages. So those are really the main drivers for me in thinking about pulling this book together as we did.
Well, interesting. Well, I'm looking forward to diving into some of the topics of the book. And again, the book will be included in our show notes. Highly recommended. Ian, before we start discussing some of the keys to leading transformational change, please allow me to ask some basic questions. And so for our listeners, how would you define then transformational change?
Yeah, we actually have a definition of it that I put in the book, a bit unusual in the sense that I chose to put it in the book a little bit more toward the end than toward the beginning, because I wanted people to get the benefit of all of these different perspectives that we've pulled together, formulate some of their own opinions and points of view without being too biased by my view before I provided it. The way that I define transformational change is really to completely rethink and reposition the what, why, how, when, who, and where of things that are associated with change. Also doing that in a way that dramatically improves the effectiveness or happiness or health or even survival of someone or something. So just to underscore a couple of points related to what I just said, for it to be transformational change, in my view, it needs to involve some degree of significant rethinking and repositioning of how things are being done and why they're being done. But it also needs to result in some definable and hopefully measurable sense of dramatic improvement. And the improvement needs to focus on effectiveness or perhaps happiness or perhaps health or perhaps survival. At the individual level, team level, organizational level, or perhaps even societal level, because the way we dove into the book, we looked at leading transformational change through a variety of lenses, which included the individual lens, the team lens, the organizational lens, and by implication, had some impact on change, large scale change, at the societal level as well. So that's how I tend to think about transformational change.
Interesting. And I had two follow-up questions for you, and bear with me because you somewhat answered those, but I just kind of want to emphasize for our listeners, what would you say then specifically drives the need for transformational change? And as you'd mentioned, Ian, you know, obviously we're really, this conversation is in the context of organizationally, it can be for, you know, community, it could be individually, right? I think some of the topics we're talking about today actually apply across those different units, right? Is that a fair statement?
Oh, yeah, a very fair statement. And it's one of the most fascinating things that I've learned in my own experience as a leader or a coach or a consultant, but also pulling the book together, where you pretty much have to acknowledge the fact that the impetus for large-scale transformational change comes from a variety of different angles, not always necessarily expected. So, for example, I think one of the big misconceptions of leading transformational change, or really any kind of change, is that it's well thought out, it's anticipatory, it's well planned for, you can see things coming around the corner that you recognize and know that you have to somehow address, and therefore that sense of anticipation and planfulness somehow seems more strategic. Now, it does turn out there are plenty of examples of successful transformational change that are in fact anticipatory, well thought out and planned for, but there's actually many more that come from unanticipated circumstances where the individual or the organization really isn't particularly well prepared. One of my favorite quotes that I put in the book is from Mike Tyson, the heavyweight boxer. He was being interviewed a number of years ago by a member of the media who was asking him about his strategy for the heavyweight bout that he was about to be in. And he said, you know, everyone has a plan until they get punched in the mouth. And I think that actually,
that's a great one.
You know, it actually applies really well to the whole concept of leading transformational change, because most organizations, even if they are anticipatory and smart enough to see around corners and connect the dots that are required to see the need for change, they still get punched in the mouth. Circumstances change, you know, almost instantly. And so there's a really high premium on organizations and individual leaders, I would say, who have the the flexibility and the agility to deal with shifting gears in the moment, to deal with the realities that they're confronting, even if they had a plan, that plan will be less than perfect and by definition will need to be adjusted many times along the way. That's a fairly significant learning for me and I think a lot of others who contributed to this book.
Yeah. Hence transformational and not transactional change.
Right.
It's a transformational process.
Exactly.
So clearly transformational change is very intentional, deliberate, and strategic in most cases. How would you define that? And I know this is a bit general question and maybe a bit loaded, but then how would you define successful transformational change based on my last two questions?
Well, going back to something that I shared in the definition, the way you measure it, of course, you know, varies quite a bit from company to company, organization to organization, circumstance to circumstance. But I think what you're always looking for generically needs to be somewhat the same across all circumstances. And that is, can you demonstrate some dramatic improvement in certain things that matter? And the things that matter might be the effectiveness of the individual or the team or the organization. It might be the happiness or health of a person or the organization. When you think about the concept of organizational health, it might also be survival. And I use that term both figuratively and literally. If you think about survival of the individual who needs to make a dramatic change in health-related practices, for example, or societies that are fighting whatever it may be that's their latest challenge, war, climate change, pick your disaster of the moment. Yeah. Does the society have the ability to dramatically change and improve things enough in order to actually fight through to the other side and survive? Those are the types of things that you ought to be looking for and measuring in order to be able to demonstrate that you've actually successfully worked your way through a large-scale transformational change.
Yeah, interesting. And I actually want to circle back on a couple of points you just made here shortly. But as you'd mentioned, it starts with there's a motivation for the change in one way, shape, or form, right? And then it's intentional, deliberate, strategic. And then once you're aligned, or if you're an individual, once you understand what that is, then I think the key word you'd mentioned, in my view, is you know it's successful because you can measure it or you attempt to measure it, right? So, maybe if you're an individual and you're looking to maybe improve your health, maybe simplifying it, but maybe not. For a lot of people, this may be a transformational change, but maybe it's as simple as getting your cholesterol level or your blood pressure to a certain point, right? If you're an organization, maybe it's, to your point, maybe it's a healthier corporate culture, which can actually be measured as well. So I think the idea here is part of that process of going through transformational change is to be as clear and articulate as you can on what your end game is and then having a way to measure that. Did I summarize that fair?
No, you summarized it extremely well. So it was very fair. And if I could, let me just add one other point to it, because in my experience, the single most important question to be asked and answered to address some of the things that we were just talking about measuring the success of transformational change is the question of from what to what, which sounds really basic until you get into it and begin actually trying to answer it. Most organizations, in my experience, make a big mistake around transformational change in that they almost immediately leap to the future. We are going to be better. The world will be a more perfect place when we do the following things. And don't get me wrong, it's absolutely essential to paint a picture of the aspiration and where you're trying to take the organization to. However, the part that's often missed and skipped over or underaddressed is where are we coming from? Do we understand what needs to be preserved? What got us here to the place we are today, where even if we need to change some things rather substantially, we are in fact still a relatively successful organization for some specific reasons. And we want to make sure that we don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, so to speak, by understanding where we came from in addition to where we're going, so that we can clarify, in fact, what needs to be preserved, while at the same time, we're prioritizing what we believe or know needs to change. And so that exercise, and it's a, I think it is actually an exercise that I see organizations failing at, probably more than succeeding at, is answering that difficult question of from what to what before you get too far down the path of concluding that all of the positives are somewhere in the future and you need to be heading there without thinking much about where you came from. If you balance it by thinking about where you came from and what needs to be preserved, you have a much, much higher chance of success in making transformational change happen and being able to, in fact, measure or define that you were able to get there.
Such a great point. I like that. You really preserve your core. You know, you preserve your strengths and improve your weaknesses, whether you're an organization or individual.
Yes, sir.
Great insight. Ian, you mentioned in your book, and I'm going to quote you here really quick, quote, "The book also includes the practical experience and perspective of an additional several hundred leaders," as you'd mentioned previously, "and thinkers who contributed through essays, interviews, a survey, and tools, all focused on the art and science of leading transformational change," end quote. And I certainly agree, Ian, that especially as a practitioner, that leading transformational change is a bit of a craft and an art. And as a researcher, I also believe that applied research has a significant role and a value in practice. That is, the quote-unquote science part of leading organizational transformation can teach us a lot about fundamental principles that can then be applied across organizational context. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I totally agree with what you said. And I also want to make sure that we're not engaging in false advertising here for any of your listeners, so that they would know what to expect if in fact they decided to pick up a copy of the book. So for sure, we use the terminology art and science, and we mean a little bit of both. Mm-hmm. But I do want to be clear that this is a very practitioner-oriented book.
Yeah.
So in addition to myself and everybody else who's contributed to this book, would typically be people who are senior leaders and executives who've driven large-scale transformational change themselves, or in some cases been driven over by it, where they're the victim and recipient of what's been changed. A lot of consultants, of course, who have a lot of expertise in that space as well, and a few academics along the way, but all written from the perspective of practical, pragmatic advice, what's real, in organizations. There's plenty of good books, I think, out there on change and lots of other things that are more research and or academically driven. This book is not. And so we're trying to take the perspective and look through the lenses of people who've actually lived it and done it and work through both the successes and the failures on the way to successful large-scale change, yeah, as opposed to something that's a little bit more researcher, academically oriented. And I just want to make sure we make that clear.
Sure. Yeah. And it is a great book, and I highly recommend it. Very well done. Great stories, great experiences shared throughout. Ian, what would you share, and what does the book share about the idea of valuing strategic vision? It seems to me that a shared vision would be a place to start for any transformation.
Yeah, one of the more important learnings from the book, in fact, one of the elements of the secret sauce that you referred to, and I imagine we'll come back to some of this further into the conversation, but this particular one applies very directly to your question, is the importance of what we call in the book define, align, and refine the what and why. So, there's a lot of effort and energy that needs to get put into helping people understand the, call it compelling need for change. This is a combination of things like set the vision so that you can help the individuals and the organization achieve mission clarity, so to speak. What is it that we're trying to get done, and why are we trying to get it done? It also includes the element, as we were talking about a couple of minutes ago, of what in fact are the ways that we measure success. And part of the ways that we measure success is the very important need to hold people accountable along the way to contributing to that success. And how are we going to hold people accountable? And maybe a third quite important element in this defining, aligning, and refining the what and why is the need to adjust course along the way. Back to our conversation about Mike Tyson and getting punched in the mouth. There's this very important element of whatever your plan is, whatever vision you've set, whatever level of sense of urgency you've created about trying to drive change, you have to build into your assumptions and to your game plan the inevitability that stuff you're going to try is not going to work. Mm. Not everything is not going to work, but some things are not going to work. And it's extremely difficult to know in advance what's going to work and what isn't going to work. So everything needs to be built around the reality and the assumption that we're going to have to make adjustments in our approach along the way. So back to your original question, setting a vision is extremely important. Helping set the tone for where the organization needs to go is extremely important. But none of that can negate the realization that you've got to bring other people along with you, help them understand what you're trying to accomplish and why, and just plan for the reality, which is that stuff's not going to work and you're going to have to make adjustments and be flexible and adaptable along the way. Otherwise, you drown before you even really know it.
Yeah. Wow. Great. Great answer, Ian. So I just want to maybe drill down a little bit further into that idea. You know, you'd mentioned obviously one of the values of strategy and alignment is being able to adjust and setting the tone, as you'd mentioned, and being flexible and bringing people along, bringing people together. And that means that there can be competing interests, right? And so one of the things I appreciated, the idea behind your chapter two actually called The Beauty of And, A-N-D, where you share that leading transformational change, perhaps more than any other aspect of leadership, is highly dependent on the will and skill to reconcile competing priorities. And then you go on to say, but truly effective transformational change is not about winners and losers or either or, it's about the beauty of and, A-N-D. Can you elaborate a little bit more on that for our listeners? As you'd mentioned, you know, this idea of bringing people along. Well, when you bring people along, there's all sorts of different motivations and knowledge and, you know, different influences that come along with that transformational effort. And so, you know, it's pretty common that there can be conflict and competing priorities. So can you drill down into that for us a little bit more?
Yeah, of course. Thanks for calling that out, because it turns out to be, in my humble opinion, one of the more important learning points from the book. Clearly, there's examples over and over and over again when you're trying to do something as complex as leading a big transformational change effort. You have to master paradox. You know, by definition, there are conflicting concepts that have to be reconciled. It does turn out quite often that, you know, two things can be true at the same time, even if they seem in some ways in opposition. And there's a number of examples of that. I mean, I talk about seven different competing priorities in the book. I don't imagine we have time to go through all seven of them now, but I'll give you a couple of examples of the list to help the listener understand a little bit what we mean by this beauty of and reconciling competing priorities. One example is facts and feelings. Here's what I mean by that. You know, just about every large-scale transformational change that takes place anywhere, you know, at the individual level, the team level, the organizational level, starts with some set of assumptions and realities around the facts that we're facing. Now, it turns out, interestingly enough, that you know, we people have this almost unlimited capacity to dismiss, deny, deflect facts that don't seem to reinforce our preferred view of the internal or external environment. Mm-hmm. It's just one of the realities of life. I think you could call it human nature. And so there's this other element which seems to be in opposition to the logic associated with facts, which is feelings. You know, at the most fundamental core level, change is about the human willingness to take on board, both in the head and the heart, the need for some type of substantial change. And it's really much more about feelings than it is about facts or logic. One of the examples that I offer in the book that I think most of us can relate to is the idea of a person concluding maybe they need to lose some weight. And you get on the scale and the numbers are staring back at you and they're irrefutable. You know, it's basically telling you you need to lose 10 pounds, let's say, for example. Now, you know, most of us know in our logical side that the facts are staring at us. We need to lose 10 pounds. And the most successful way to do that is usually some combination of diet and exercise. However, nothing will happen unless the individual internalizes the need for diet and exercise and actually begins the act of diet and exercise. Simple act of stepping on the scale, realizing that you're 10 pounds overweight in and of itself is not enough to drive change or change your behavior or your weight. And there are literally millions of examples that happen almost every day in organizations where the facts are staring you in the face, but nothing is going to happen to address those facts unless the individuals who are responsible for making something happen in their head and in their heart internalize the need to make that something happen. That is a way of reconciling the competing priority between facts and feelings. Another example, and then I'll see if you have any questions about what I've said, is the reconciliation between speed and rhythm. And here's what I mean by that. You know, most people will tell you that successful transformational change usually requires moving faster than has traditionally felt comfortable. And there's a certain discomfort, obviously, associated with moving at that kind of pace if that's not what you or the organization are historically used to. And so speed matters in successful transformational change. But there's also, in my experience, importance of rhythm. And here's how I tend to think about it. I play a little bit of guitar, certainly not well enough to make a living at it. But one of the things that I learned from being around music and musicians is, you know, rarely will you find a musician that tells you playing the song faster and getting to the end more quickly in and of itself improves the song. What musicians will tell you is you've got to have everybody on the same sheet of music. The song has to go at a certain pace and rhythm. We want to make sure that people are playing in harmony. And at the end of the day, being able to do all those things tends to make for more beautiful music. Playing the song faster does not necessarily make for more beautiful music. And in fact, in many cases, if you think about it, music played in harmonious fashion and at the appropriate rhythm is beautiful. Music that isn't is basically noise. And that's the same principle that applies to the pacing and emphasis on speed in driving transformational change. Yes, speed matters, and moving faster than you would typically like to move usually leads to more success. But you've got to bring, you know, other members of the band, so to speak, along with you at the appropriate rhythm and pace. Otherwise, you're just going to create noise in the organization, and speed by itself will not get you where you want to go.
Yeah, key point. And I highly recommend that our listeners check out your book, but I really liked your 7 paradoxes. They're great points that I think any transformational change agent or practitioner should really take a step back and reflect on some of these. And one of the things, Ian, you know, as you said, feelings and emotions are a part of being human, right? And it's a non-escapable reality of transformational change. And then you take these human beings and you put them in different teams, right? Or maybe different stakeholder groups or departments, whatever it is in that organization. And that can create certain dynamic complexities. So I guess my question is just to drill down a little bit further, if you don't mind, on that idea of facts and feelings. In general, what does your book share with us in terms of the value of teamwork and teams? Because often in ERP organizational change, as I'd mentioned, there are various stakeholder groups, and often they can have various levels of diversity in terms of experience, knowledge, motivation, etc. What can you add in terms of stakeholder alignment and maybe the idea of toxic positivity? Because I think that, in my view, these points that you just spoke of are, I normally would put those in the category of stakeholder management. And I think it's often an undervalued and undermanaged factor, so it seems to me, during a large scale transformational change.
Yes, let me address it from a couple of different angles that came through loud and clear in multiple ways in the book. One side of the equation would be another element of the secret sauce, if you will, which is what ended up calling go first, but not alone, right? So pretty much every successful example of change you can point to, obviously, in some way or another, is heavily influenced by or starts with a leader who recognizes the need for change and has the courage, perhaps, to call it out. And then help begin to drive it. However, there are very, very few examples, if any, of successfully leading transformational change where a leader did it by themselves.
Yeah.
And even change at the individual level, like the example we were talking earlier about, you know, let's lose some weight. Very rarely does the individual who loses weight do it all by themselves. You know, they're usually surrounded by other people who are providing at minimum positive reinforcement, in some cases supported by, you know, a personal trainer or friends at the gym or others who are sharing in the dieting process to help bring people along. So it's quite typical for a successful transformational change, even when there's a highly effective leader, to be surrounded by other people who can contribute in substantial ways to making it happen. You know, one of the expressions we use in the book is leaders of transformational change travel in packs. You know, they're not doing it alone. The second portion of that learning that also speaks directly to the question that you were just asking is about the importance of diversity and pulling together people with very different, diverse perspectives and lenses, not only on change or the need for change, but also the how. Mm-hmm. Because one thing that I see leaders mistakenly do over and over and over again is they figure it's really a facts-based discussion. You know, if I can convince you through facts and data of the compelling need for change, you know, our financials are terrible, or our customer satisfaction scores are terrible, or we can demonstrate evidence through facts and data that competitors are coming in and stealing our lunch, I can persuade you of the need for large-scale change, even if it might be uncomfortable. And as we were talking about earlier, even though all that data is extremely helpful, rarely is it enough. You have to surround yourself with diverse people who have alternate points of view, who may see the external or internal environment that you're dealing with in different ways than you do. Mm-hmm. And then lo and behold, you actually have to listen to and allow yourself to be influenced by them. Mm-hmm. And that whole team effectiveness element that you introduced comes through loud and clear over and over in all these examples that we picked up through the book, of recognizing that you're basically not going to get it done alone, and you're not going to get it done if everybody thinks like you do. And there's a variety of different examples that come through in the book on that. And one of the things we can either get into now or a little bit later is this idea of who are the influencers and who are the resistors in the organization, because those kinds of people also will make a huge difference in successfully making change happen.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to get your idea on the definition of organizational culture. And so when you put this book together and you looked at these stories and these various experiences with all these great practitioners and leaders, what would you say is the impact on successful transformation that organizational culture has. So can you just give your definition of organizational culture, and then what is that impact on transformation? Because I think everything that we're talking about so far in this conversation, a lot of it I roll up into this larger category called organizational culture that helps set the tone for some of these ideas that you're talking about, right? So can you maybe share on those couple of points with our listeners?
Yeah, I'll build on a very simple definition of organizational culture with a couple of maybe additions to it. So first, the simple definition, I like to think of organizational culture as what people do when no one else is watching. And, right. It really kind of gives you a sense of, you know, without leadership there, without people inspecting it in, without people pounding on you and beating on you, you know, what is it that people tend to believe are the behaviors that matter most to the success of the organization, and they actually, you know, behave in ways that are consistent with that. It turns out, though, there's a couple of other elements in particular, I won't list all of them, that really seem to matter a lot in connecting organizational culture to this idea of transformational change. One of which has to do with, how does the organization deal with failure? You know, does it spend most of its time trying to figure out what didn't work and why it didn't work and how we can learn from it so that we improve in the future? Or does it spend most of its energy organizationally trying to figure out whose fault was it and who screwed up and how can we punish, torture, or get rid of that person who made the mistake? Mm-hmm. Every organization has, you know, different elements that are positive and negative about their culture. But if you want to look to a common denominator of organizations that seem to do better at these large-scale transformational changes, typically an organization that kills the people who make mistakes, you know, that tries, they try things, complicated, difficult, but necessary things, and perhaps they don't succeed, or they don't succeed the first time. All you have to do is once or twice very prominently punish or fire or torture in some other way the people who didn't succeed, and everybody else takes their cue from that pretty quickly. So if you have a culture that tends to promote not necessarily an acceptance of failure, I'm not suggesting that you should embrace failure and think it's awesome. What I'm suggesting is recognize the inevitability of certain failure along the way as you try difficult, complicated things, and also recognize likewise the importance of not beating up or destroying or diminishing or firing the people who made those mistakes in the spirit of trying to find better ways to do things. If you can embrace the inevitability of failure, you almost by definition embrace the notion of the importance of big, complicated change, because big, complicated change is by its definition difficult.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I think the next question here, and I'm just curious, in your book, and again, for our listeners, we're talking about the secret sauce for leading transformational change. There's many factors shared throughout your book that leaders deploy, right? And just to share some with our listeners, this includes terms such as set a new vision, mission, or sense of purpose, drive culture change and innovation, build a new team, insisted on collaboration, held people accountable, communicated more transparently, made people feel like owners, recognized change champions, built trust, took risk, learned from failures. And it seems to me a common theme, Ian, throughout the book is that the successful transformational leaders are quite reflective. And you also mentioned in your book that every leader learned from both what they did and what they did not do. So I guess my question is reflection a natural thing for leaders, or does it come with intent and practice, or is it somehow something, a lesson learned? What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I'll start with the premise that it's really not natural for most people. And so it's more rare than it is common. But, you know, not to sound too cynical, I would say that the leaders who are more reflective, who learn from experience and mistakes, like we were just talking about with failures, and encourage other people to do the same, are almost always going to be, especially over the long term, much more successful at leading change than people who are much less reflective, because those less reflective people, as we saw over and over again, tended not to learn from mistakes, tended to repeat them, tended to blame other people for them, and tended to, you know, almost dismiss things that didn't work as somehow the fault of the process or other people or lack of resources. It was almost other focused. You know, it's almost always other focused. It's some other reason why things didn't work. It's some other person that dropped the ball and didn't do their job.
Yeah.
And a highly reflective leader generally figures out pretty quickly that while there probably were plenty of things that contributed to the lack of success, perhaps the single most important one was me, the leader. You know, and what did I do or not do? What could I have done differently to set the right tone, to provide the right resources, to offer the right encouragement and guidance to people to more successfully execute on the change that we were trying to execute on? So reflection turns out to be an extraordinarily important element of the character and the behavior of successful leaders of transformational change.
Yeah, that's interesting. I asked that question deliberately because I, in some of my own formal qualitative research, I would say hands down with some of the transformational leaders, a primary, I think, attribute or character across the board was a very reflective nature. Just the ability to really reflect and ask questions and really learn from their experiences. So very, very interesting answer there, Ian. Thank you for that. But I would like to actually piggyback on that question in regards to a common denominator. One of your chapters is a compilation of great input from 150 people who have led transformational changes, been affected by them or both, as you'd previously mentioned, Ian. And your book shares that primary themes that emerged were, and you touched on a couple of these, but I'd like to repeat these for our listeners. But number one, go first, but not alone. Number two, define, align, and refine the what and why. And three, energize the village. Those were three primary themes that emerged throughout this work and stories from 150 people. So I'm going to save the meat and potatoes for our listeners, Ian, and I just they need to read your book. But please tell me more about the energizing the village piece and what does that look like tactically?
Yeah, the energizing the village piece really comes back to this whole question of the hearts and minds of the human beings who have to drive and participate in the change. So, you know, one of the things we say a number of different times in the book is leading transformational change takes a village. You're obviously not going to do it by yourself. But a big portion of leadership success and making it happen is creating the energy and the engagement that's required to bring these other people around. You know, one of the contributors to the book described it as creating and promoting pull, you know, so that you've got, you know, individuals that, you know, want to be part of the change and understand what is being asked of them rather than having this, you know, large, scary, complicated change pushed on them and them trying to figure out, you know, whether it's something that they should embrace or whether they should resist, you know, with every fiber of their being. Now, a lot of people, you know, always ask the question, you know, is there any magic to creating that energy and engagement and excitement and making it fun? Because not all aspects of big change is fun. And there's no one magic bullet, but one consistency that comes through over and over again that seems to work better than most things is listen, listen, and listen some more. You know, I think a lot of times we talk about successful change. One of the big elements of success is communication, you know, at its most generic level. What I worry about, even though communication, of course, is important, is when you talk about the importance of communication, people's heads almost always go to tell, 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 you know, particularly if I'm a leader, you know, I'm going to spend a lot of my time telling you about the compelling need for change and telling you about the facts and telling you about the data and telling you about all these things that require that we do things differently. And a certain amount of telling is important, but it needs to be far, far outweighed by listening, understanding from other people's perspectives at a variety of different levels in the organization, what's happening with the customer, what's happening with the external environment, what's happening with your employee base, and where the biggest obstacles are that need to be overcome and where the biggest hassles are that are getting in the way of people doing the best job that they can possibly do. All of that comes from listening. And it turns out if you're a great listener as a leader, that is unbelievably energizing and motivating to the people who are being heard, because in most cases, they feel like they haven't been heard for a very long time.
Yeah. And I think, Ian, listening to your response to my questions today and listening to the way that you describe effective leaders, you know, transformational change leaders, I'm certainly picking up on two attributes. And one is this idea of empathy, leadership with empathy, and the other is just listening. Right, which I suppose in a way, good and active listening is a form of empathy. You know, and there's been a lot of work, there's been a lot of research done that really demonstrates quite well that those are two pretty important attributes of transformational leaders for sure. Ian, I really appreciate your time today. And if you don't mind, I have about three more questions I'd really love to ask you. And my next one is, in your chapter 8, it's titled, Don't Do It. And you share a fantastic point that I'd like you to share with our listeners. And that is, don't, quote, confuse doing things differently with improving results, end quote. Can you elaborate on this idea? And what I'd like to know is, in your experience, how much do you see this happening?
Yeah, I see it happening a lot. You know, I refer to it maybe as the new sheriff in town syndrome, you know, where yeah. a new leader of the organization comes in, and by definition, they want to show that somebody new is in charge, so we're going to do things differently.
Yeah.
And that's all fine, except for the fact that there is a huge difference between doing things differently and improving things. That came through many, many times in many ways as we were putting this book together. And so, you know, for anybody who's listening, I would offer up the advice that not only don't confuse difference with improvement, but understand that when you change things intentionally or even unintentionally, it's a system. You know, one thing leads to another, which leads to another, which leads to another. And before you know it, not only have you changed the one thing that you thought was appropriate to change, but by definition, you changed 5 or 10 or 15 other things that you didn't realize were connected. And that creates a fair degree of confusion, but it also makes it extremely difficult to know whether the original thing that you changed made any difference at all. And so, you know, think twice or three times about what are the most important things that would make the biggest difference to change, all in the name of serving some measure of improvement, and particularly improvement that helps the organization and the individuals in it win. And not every change helps the organization or the individuals in it win. And those things ought to be a little bit more suspect as priorities for change as compared to the things that do contribute to winning at the individual and team and organizational levels.
Yeah, right. Wow. Great insight. You know, some of these questions, again, we could probably spend an hour or two just talking about one or two of these topics and digging deeper. But this is great stuff. Thank you so much. Okay, Ian, without giving away the full sauce, I think we should leave that up to our listeners to explore your book. But you shared a lot of insight with us today. But what exactly is the key idea of the secret sauce for leading transformational change?
Well, it turns out, first of all, not to disappoint, but there isn't, in my experience, one key idea as much as it is the blend, a variety of different things that all go into, you know, as if you were, you know, putting together a secret sauce recipe for your pizza or your pasta. It's what goes into it in terms of the individual ingredients and how they interact. There's 10 different elements of the secret sauce that we talk about in the book. Obviously, we don't have time to cover all those here. And we already addressed a few of them. So I'm just going to touch on maybe two for purposes of our conversation, Jack, that we haven't really talked all that much about.
Sure.
Really, the first one, which we describe in the book, is start with truth, talent, and timing. Now, we've talked about a couple of these things already, so I'm just going to hit on them very lightly. But the most important one is this element of truth. So first thing you do in successful transformational change, bar none, is define reality. You know, understand the circumstances that your organization is facing.
Oh, that's a good one.
is what it is. You are where you are. As I mentioned earlier, people have this enormous capacity for denying or deflecting or explaining away data that they don't like or they don't agree with. That's usually a killer, right? So the first part is start with truth, understand the circumstances that you're in, and then to the elements of talent and timing, surround yourself with really good people who can help you address these truths. And timing is move faster than feels generally comfortable, like we were talking about earlier. The other element of secret sauce, though, that I want to hit on because we didn't spend much time on it so far, is this idea of love, influencers, and resistors. And here's what I mean by that. You know, most of us as individuals and as leaders tend to gravitate toward people who we think share our view of the world, you know, and who reinforce our perspective about the need for change and why it's needed and what the changes are that we should be bringing about. And that's fine. However, I also find the perspective of understanding who key influencers are in the organization is really important because they're not always people in senior leadership positions. They're often people who are highly regarded, highly respected, highly experienced. They may be, you know, 10 layers down in the organization. They may be an individual contributor, but they might be somebody who is really highly respected by a wide variety of people in the organization. And quite often, these influencers are often looked to by many other people in the organization for cues and signals about whether they should be supportive of or resistant to the changes that are being brought about. So understanding who the influencers are is extremely important in getting a leg up on helping other people get more comfortable with the change. At the same time, however, there's really important other kinds of people who exist in the organization who you might think of as resistors. These people are generally a bit more skeptical. They're generally more willing to ask tough questions and push back on things that they either don't understand or don't agree with. And quite often, they're doing that in the spirit of simply trying to make the change better, more effective, and more likely to succeed. So if you tend to marginalize those kind of people or dismiss them or push them out too quickly because they're not, quote unquote, getting on board fast enough, you end up losing very valuable input and perspective from people who want to make things work, but they're simply, you know, asking some of the tough questions and pushing back on some of the unpopular things that many other people are thinking, but don't have the courage or the guts to say out loud. And both those resistors and those influencers are extremely important, particularly when it comes down to, you know, ignoring the organization chart to a certain degree and finding the people in the organization who, no matter where they sit, whether they're in positions of leadership or not, whether they're at the top of the organization or the middle or the bottom, are actually going to help you drive change. That's one of the most important elements of the secret sauce that we discovered.
And that's critical. And that's a topic, Ian, that we could definitely talk about for an hour, I think. And, you know, part of that's this idea of maybe organizational politics. And there actually is such a thing as good politics, right? And I think in a way that it's doing just that. It's leveraging your different influencers in all the right ways for positive transformational change. What a fascinating idea, for sure. Okay, Ian, my last question. If you were going to give advice to an organization regarding successful transformational change or transformational leadership, can you leave our listeners with a nice little golden nugget?
Yeah, I think the golden nugget I'll leave them with that harkens back to some references in the book where we talk about what does pizza have to do with leading transformational change. I'll say that, you know, one of the most important quotes that I picked up in pulling this book together is to believe in yourself. If cauliflower can become pizza, you can become anything.
Right. Great advice. Great advice. We'll leave it at that. That's well said. Ian, thank you for your time today. I really like your book. I appreciate the work. I appreciate the contribution from so many really good leaders, their stories, their experiences, their insight. Highly recommended. So thank you for that. Can you tell our listeners how they can get in touch with you and learn more?
Absolutely. Thank you for having me and for asking that question. Probably best place to go, one-stop shopping, is the book website, which is www.transformationalchangebook.com, where people can get more information about the book and summaries of the chapters, learn more about the contributing authors, including myself, order the book at a discount. And of course, it's a way of them connecting and reaching out to me directly as well. So thank you, Jack. I really appreciate you having me today.
You're very welcome. And thank you again, Ian. Be well, and we'll talk soon.
Look forward to it.
Thank you for joining us for today's episode of the ERP OCJ podcast. This podcast is intended as a forum to study, share, and discuss ERP organizational change successes and challenges. We discuss the people, process, and technological components of ERP organizational change by drawing on knowledge from extensive research, collaborative learning, and practitioner expertise and experience. We are incredibly grateful to have friends, colleagues, and mentors join us in our podcast as we seek to promote, connect, and foster relationships in the ERP organizational change community and contribute to its success by bringing research and practice closer together. We want to make sure this is the most useful and insightful ERP podcast you listen to, and we'd love your help in doing so by leaving us feedback and a review. A great place to do so is at Apple Podcasts. Just click on the Listen in Apple Podcasts link, then click Ratings and Reviews, and let us know your thoughts. You can get more info about the show, including show notes and episode highlights for this and all of our episodes, by visiting nesselandassociates.com and clicking the podcast option. Please join us again next week as we discuss the latest ERP organizational change research, practice, and stories. And don't forget to follow us on social media, hashtag the ERP OCJ. Thanks again for listening. Have a fantastic week.